Hi, everyone. This is indeed Malcolm Brown, and I'm joined by my colleague, Veronica Diaz.
Hello, everyone, and I'll be talking in just a little bit.
And thanks to all of you for taking time from your busy schedule to join us today. Now, as advertised, we'll be taking a close look at the 2014 Horizon Report for Higher Education. Now, what's on this slide is our table of contents for the webinar today. To start off, we'll take a look at what's new, since the Horizon Report for 2014 has undergone a bit of a makeover. Next, we will cover the methodology behind this report, as that is an important part of the Horizon Report's context, but also a part of its credibility. The next step will take us to the trends and challenges. It is here that the new approach to the Horizon Report is most evident, so it will be worth taking some time to consider them. These trends and challenges are integrated more thoroughly with the technologies than in past years, which provides a perhaps more organic relationship between these three components, trends, challenges, and the technologies. We'll then catch up with the technologies and see why the word here, development, is in quotes. And finally, as Mark mentioned, we are fortunate to have with us today a pair of speakers who will showcase innovative work that they are doing that relates directly to the trends identified in the report. So we have a lot of ground to cover, so let's get going. Now, we will be tossing some polls your way throughout the session, as this is a great way to tap into our collective insight. So I'd like to ask that the first poll be posted. And this is a poll for those of you who are Horizon Report veterans, so to speak. The question is, which of the sections do you find the most valuable? So please pick a moment and pick the one that you find the most valuable. Now, I'm going to push on to the next section of the report, and we'll return to the results of this poll in just a moment, but please continue to participate in the poll and register your vote if you haven't already done so. So, what's new in this year's report? Perhaps the quickest way to get a sense of that is to take a look at the table of contents. So here are all the components of the Horizon Report, and if you are a student of past reports, you may think that at first glance, there's not much that has changed. But all the sections I'm marking here with this red mark have seen changes to some extent or the other. So let's take a look back at the poll and see where people weighed in. This is interesting that this is not what I would have expected, actually, that the winner, so to speak, is the trends, and it's not necessarily the technologies, but I also see there's a strong element of people who think that it's all the above. So that's very interesting. Thank you for sharing and participating in the poll. All right. So here is the table of contents from last year's report. Now, it looks familiar, doesn't it, with trends and challenges and technologies classified according to the familiar adoption horizon. But now let's compare it to the table of contents for this year's report. You'll notice that the trends and challenges have been assigned to one of three groups. So like the technologies, they are now grouped according to three horizons as well. The Horizon Report describes the trends horizons in this way, quote, fast-moving trends will realize their impact in the next 1 to 2 years, and two categories of slower trends that will realize their impact within 3 to 5 or more years. The same approach has been taken for the challenges, and here's how the report describes the challenge horizons. Quote, solvable challenges are those that we both understand and know how to solve, but seemingly lack the will. Difficult challenges are ones that are more or less well understood, but for which solutions remain elusive. And wicked challenges, the most difficult, are complex even to define, and thus require additional data and insights before solutions will even be possible. Now, another element that is used in this year's Horizon Report is this report that was issued by the Joint Research Council of the European Commission, published in 2012. According to the Horizon Report, this particular report on the Creative Classrooms project was used throughout the Horizon Report to tease out the implications of the technologies and trends and challenges for policy, leadership, and effective practice. In other words, this JRC report and the model it contains served as a kind of lens to make visible these policy, leadership, and practice dimensions of the report's findings. Now, obviously, this is not the point or the time. We don't have the time to go into the GRC report in great detail. I invite you all to pick up a copy, and I'll be showing a URL where to get a copy in just a moment. But the aim of this JRC report is to provide the key or list the key components of technology-enabled innovative learning environments. And furthermore, this report states that the term classrooms is used in the widest sense as including all types of learning environments in both formal and informal settings. Very quickly, the JRC report identifies 8 key dimensions they see are very, very important for what they call creative classrooms. And then they list a roster of 26 of what they call reference parameters that relate to that. Now, this is all a little complex, and I realize there's not time to go into it now. However, if you'll follow this URL, you'll be able to pick up a copy of the report and read it when you have the time to do so. I do recommend reading the report. It has some great ideas in it. And with that, I'm going to turn things over to Veronica.
Thanks, Malcolm. So the Horizon Report is put together with the assistance of the Horizon Report Advisory Board, which has over 53 members from the U.S. and several other countries like China, Brazil, Germany, India, Spain, Switzerland, the U.K., Australia, Canada, and Japan. And if you're interested in serving on the Horizon Report Advisory Board, you can contact NMC. They periodically take a look around to see who might be interested and are always looking for new members. There's currently 7 categories of technologies that the NMC monitors continuously, and those are consumer technologies, digital strategies, enabling technologies, internet technologies, learning technologies, social media technologies, and visualization technologies. And these are not a closed set, but rather they're intended to provide a way to illustrate and organize emerging technologies into pathways of development that are or may be relevant to learning and creative inquiry. And new technologies are added to the list in almost every research cycle of the report, and the categories serve as lenses for thinking about innovation. And I'm going to be posting links here in the chat as we go through to give you more information, places to go for more information. So there's a fairly comprehensive process for collecting information for the report, and the advisory board guides the entire process. The Horizon Report team provides an initial list of news clippings that are culled from a variety of sources, and we monitor those on a regular basis. The board then goes through these and adds more or adds comments or how or why they think they may or may not be important, and they also vote on an entirely full set, and they identify items of high interest to the higher education community. And if you're interested, you can follow the Horizon Report and the development process on Twitter by following the hashtag NMCHorizon on Twitter. Here you see kind of a snapshot of the Horizon Report's advisory board responses to just one of the research questions. And we'll discuss those next, but it's a very active and highly participatory process, and it's our way of collecting information across higher education organizations around the world. Now, I want to give you a quick look at the research questions that guide the report. And following the extensive review of the literature, the board engages in the central focus of the research, which is the research questions. These questions are designed just to elicit a comprehensive set of interesting technologies, challenges, and trends. And one of the board's most important tasks is to answer these questions as systematically and broadly as possible to ensure that the range of relevant topics is considered. And once this work is done, a process that moves pretty quickly over just a few days, the advisory board moves to a unique consensus-building process that's based on an iterative Delphi-based methodology. So the first question is, which of the key technologies cataloged in the report listing will be most important to teaching, learning, or creative expression within the next 5 years? And I want to make a point here that although this question asks specifically about technologies, we're seeing many of these important developments in EdTech focus on the application of technology to support learning. For instance, if you look at the categories of the topics that were tracked in the 2014 report, you're going to notice that many that are supported by technology, but not actually a technology, such as the flipped classroom or makerspaces or even gamification. And I think this is an important and a positive development for those of us that are in teaching, in the teaching and learning space. Question two asks, what key technologies are missing from our list? What would you list among the established technologies that are arguably important for all institutions that should be considered more broadly to support or enhance teaching and learning? And question three points to the key challenges related to teaching, learning, and creative inquiry over the next 5 years. Question four finally asks, what trends do you expect to have a significant impact on the educational institution's core missions? So really tying it back to some of those core issues. And here's the project timeline with each step at a glance. And I guess that's back to you, Malcolm.
Thanks, Veronica. So if you do have questions for us or for our presenters later, please feel free to enter them into the chat and we'll address them when we have a moment. So I'd like to go on to talking about the trends and challenges section of the 2014 report. Now, as I indicated in the introduction, the trends and challenges section of the Horizon Report has been revised since last year. And since they really do describe the context for educational technologies, it's worth spending a few minutes to take a closer look at these. You'll also note that if you compare the 2014 trends and challenges to what's appeared in previous issues of the Horizon Report, you will see not only have the trends and challenges been re-envisioned, but the trends and challenges themselves have been renewed. It's a very, very different look and feel altogether. So first a word about what a trend is and what a challenge is. Trends are accelerators. They drive technology investment and deployment decisions. Challenges, by contrast, are impediments. They are elements in the environment or perhaps in the campus culture that can work against the adoption and deployment of educational technology. Such impediments also, of course, slow down the rate of innovation and the adoption of key new best practices. Now, obviously, both trends and challenges have implications for campus leadership, for policy, and for campus practice, and it seems like you can't have one without the other. Hence, in order to move forward, we must take both into account. Obviously, if we think of trends in isolation, the picture may look too rosy. Taken all by itself, technology always seems cool, and we might conclude superficially that the coolness factor alone will serve to move the adoption of innovation forward. Now, conversely, if we dwell only on the challenges, we run the risk of becoming like Winnie the Pooh's Eeyore, where everything is so discouraging that there seems to be little sense in undertaking anything. So the Horizon Report offers us good counsel to keep both the trends and the challenges in view and to take them into account when addressing leadership, policy, and practice issues all relating to educational technology. So on the slide that is on the screen now, this is a listing of the trends according to their categories or horizons as laid out in the 2014 report. There's not a lot of time today to go into all of these in detail, so I'm just going to remark on a few of them. The second one in the first horizon, the learning integration, this is the integration or ubiquity of hybrid and collaborative learning. And really, if you think about it, online learning permeates all of teaching and learning, whether it be pure online learning in the sense of an online degree program or a set of courses, all the way down to blended learning and hybrid courses. So the online dimension really has become ubiquitous in throughout our teaching and learning. This means that there is more collaboration using social media than ever before. It also allows a freedom of interaction and personalization that has never been possible before. It enables more peer-to-peer learning than has ever been possible before. And finally, it offers perhaps a path to more easily scale innovations than has been true in the past. So this is why this is a trend, and this is why this particular trend, the Horizon Report recommends to us, is so close in terms of the fast-moving trend, in other words. The other couple of trends just to note here are the two in the long-range ones, the agile approaches. What's interesting here and what the Horizon Report documents is that teaching and learning now, some teaching and learning programs or approaches are beginning to mimic startups. That is, they are having student projects within the course mimic or pretend they are participating or competing for technology funding. And some are actually even going beyond that, and they're taking these models that the students generate and actually seeking actual dollars for those ideas. So this is just one example of the agile approaches that some schools are taking in order to think about where the innovation and where the opportunities lie. Similarly, for the evolution of online education, the count of students, as we know, taking online courses is continuing to increase. And the critical components for online education continue to be engagement, the interactive features, and a sense of community, and as well as a strong instructor presence. We're going to be seeing adaptive technology play a critical role on online education, and libraries of resources will also play a critical role, such as Stanford has done with their iTunes U resources.
Go ahead and introduce the poll, and while they're filling out the poll, I have a couple questions.
Okay, that sounds fine. So here's the next poll. I hadn't a chance to describe all the trends, but based on what you can see from them, which one do you think is the most important one for higher education? Go ahead, Mark, please.
So while they're filling out, one of the questions was student as creators in a 3 to 5 year range, and the question was, well, isn't that already happening? So can you give an explanation of what your definition of becoming, is the trend becoming full force? Why 3 to 5 years? Does that mean, 50% use it? Or, what's the measurement or what's the idea?
Well, I think, yes. It can't be denied that, particularly with the digital media, that students have been creating content for years. Again, by putting it into that horizon, it's not saying that it's not at work today. The Horizon Report is suggesting that the full impact will be within the time range suggesting. One of the dimensions of this that the Horizon Report looks at is makerspaces. And in that particular, from that sense, the student as creators in that kind of hands-on analog sense, that is something that is gaining steam but will take a while before it sees ubiquity, I think, across all of higher education.
And so one last quick one. Somebody asked earlier, so we've been seeing you, not you, but the ELI put out and the Horizon Report put out trends, and I know we've all used them in presentations and changes. Have you done a historical view of what your accuracy of prediction and how that worked? Done any research on that?
That's a really good question. Well, this is the first year that the trends have been put into these horizons, so trying to do a prediction, there's no longitudinal way to kind of do that for these. And it's often asked about, well, what about the technologies? How good has the production, could you win at the stock market if you were this accurate or not? I think the prediction of the adoption of the wide-scale or ubiquitous adoption of these technologies is pretty tricky, and there has been some backwards and forwards, so it's not as if the Horizon Report is accurate each year and on target each year. I do think that, for me, one of the main values of the Horizon Report is a conversation starter or a conversation enabler. It really kind of lights a campfire, so to speak, around which we can have good conversations about things. But there have been some folks who have looked at some of the accuracy, and there are some folks, there is one article, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, that made a more systematic review of the accuracy of the Horizon Report with respect to the technologies. It came out feeling actually pretty good about what the Horizon Report does.
Great. I'll let you head back to the poll response.
Okay, the poll responses. So we have a clear winner here with the integration of online, and that would seem to be not terribly surprising, as well as a strong component for the data-driven learning. That seems to be in keeping with what's on most people's minds. So thank you again for participating in that poll. And finally, just to quickly just finish up with the challenges, again, these are the 6 challenges grouped according to their categories, as I mentioned at the outset. Again, I'm just going to comment on a few of them. The one that I find interesting is the one on rewarding teaching or rewards for teaching. The report points out that all manner of faculty, from adjuncts to lecturers to faculty with tenure, can do good teaching. But what's interesting is that the report brings up some studies that say that faculty have experimented, but teaching is getting so complex now that even veteran instructors can feel a little bit, have their confidence shaken a bit, given the new complexity. So that's a kind of a trend within a trend, if you will. They document a study in the UK noting that there was an actual decrease in the interaction rates with faculty. Derek Buck at Harvard did a study that they mentioned saying that the grad training to become instructors is not sufficient, that teaching today is more difficult than ever. And with the new mix of adjuncts and faculty with tenure, we will need to be thinking very, very carefully about teaching rewarding and how all this comes together. Also, in terms of scaling innovations, the Horizon Report points out that accreditation can, in some cases, actually reinforce traditional teaching practices. So that might be a challenge you might need to think about. There are new paths. We all know that there are new paths to degrees being forged all the time. There are capacity issues that we need. That's another challenge within this challenge that might impede integration. And new visions for how to scale, particularly across gateway courses, is a challenge that we continue to face. So these are some of the, I think, the interesting challenges. And so we're going to have another poll. Now, having looked at these challenges for a bit, would you please weigh in? Which one do you think is the most pressing one for higher education right now? Which of these challenges that have been documented in the Horizon Report do you think are the most challenging? And
Malcolm, while they're filling it out, another real quick one, and I gotta watch your timing, but there was a comment that said something about that student as creators is more than a tech process, and I think that's kind of true of a lot of these things. Some of them are pedagogy, some of them are process, some of them are technology-enhanced processes. Do you make a differentiation in those things, or is that just
the
gestalt of the answers?
That question is extremely well-timed because I'm going to hand things over to Veronica in just a second. She's going to have more to say about that. That if you take a look at what's described as technologies in the Horizon Report, you'll see a bit of a difference. There's the flipped classroom, which itself is not a technology so much, but really a practice that unites or brings together various technologies. So I think the picture in terms of educational technologies and what we focus on is changing a bit. So anyway, I'm going to wrap up here now. Okay, so digital fluency of faculty is seen, or faculty development is seen as, I guess, the leading pressing challenge here, and the rewards for teaching is in second place. All right, well, thank you very much, everyone, for participating in the poll. It's always useful to see what everyone's thinking. And now I'm going to turn things over to Veronica.
Thanks, Malcolm, and we will be talking a little bit about faculty development towards the end of the webinar today, so that's great that that came up so early. So I wanted to mention that the responses to the research questions that I showed earlier are systematically ranked and placed into adoption horizons by each of the advisory board members, and we do that using a multi-vote system that allows members to weight each of their selections. And each member is asked to also identify the time frame during which they feel the technology would enter mainstream use. And speaking of mainstream use, a question came up about this earlier. That is defined as about 20% of institutions adopting it within the period discussed. So these rankings are then compiled into a collective set of responses. The ones around which there is the most agreement is quickly apparent, so there's lots of agreement among the board members. And from the comprehensive list of technologies, the 12 that emerge at the top of the initial ranking process, 4 per adoption horizon, are further researched and expanded, and then the short list is identified. The group begins to explore the ways in which these 12 important technologies might be used in teaching and learning, and that's kind of how we arrive at the technologies. So if I could just get this poll to come up, you saw kind of what the technologies are that the board identified, but I wanted to know which of the 6 technologies you think will have the greatest impact on teaching and learning. So I'll let that poll open up there. And just take a second to think about what you've seen and your own institutional context and see if you're kind of in line. This will be an interesting little test. We've got about 350 participants in the room today, so a little microcosm of teaching and learning in higher ed, hopefully. All right, so it looks like you are pretty much in agreement with flipped learning and close second coming in at learning analytics. Okay, all right, great. Thanks, Lauren. So this past February at the ELI annual meeting in New Orleans, some of you may have attended, The ELI conducted its first Horizon Report video competition, where we asked anyone from the teaching and learning community to submit a 3-minute video showcasing their work in one of the Horizon Report technology areas. We received, in a very short period of time, I might add, nearly 2,000 votes in response to the technology videos that were submitted, and I wanted to share some of those with you today. So without any further delay, Lauren, if you would pull up this video for us, and we'll all just take a couple minutes to watch it. While that's loading, I'll mention that this is Marist College, their learning analytics video submission, and this was the one that received the top votes. Thanks, Lauren. So before I go on to our next video, I wanted to show a side-by-side view of the Horizon technologies in their Horizon order, and also the community submissions of the videos by the topic. In other words, we received more learning analytics submissions than any other. Then the flipped classroom and so on. And this gives us a little bit of insight into where the community is relative to emerging technology adoption. So now we're going to take a look at Ohio State University's video on the flipped classroom, and this came in second place. So Lauren?
Assuming it's loading, so Veronica, maybe I'll ask you a quick question while we get it to load.
Yeah, sure.
There was a slide earlier that talked about digital fluency, and the question was, is does that go across all devices, not just computers, but smart devices, tablets, Google Glass, you name it?
Well, I think it depends on the device when we're talking about fluency, but I think typically it means fluency as it relates to application to teaching and learning. So let me see. Here I'm getting a note from Lauren. They're reloading the pod, so it should be playing in just 1 second.
This is Malcolm. Mark, also responding to your question here. Digital fluency is not only just being adroit with the devices, obviously, but it's also being able to find the right information and use it in the right and creative ways in order to move forward with academic projects.
So it is focused on the use in an academic learning environment, if you will.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
From the point of view of the Horizon Report, most definitely.
Great. And it seems that this one particular video is struggling.
Yeah, and I,
Well, I can ask another question, or we can skip to the next slide. Veronica? Oh, wait. Here we go.
Isn't technology fun sometimes? So, Mark, while we're waiting, I could address that question on the quantified self.
Actually, I'm seeing the video, Malcolm. So,
yeah,
okay,
the video, fine. The video is playing.
Seems like there's still a lot of video problems and we've got dead air. I'm going to suggest we pause the video and move on to the next slide.
Sure,
it
that
seems
sounds
to be causing
fine.
All sorts of problems.
Great. So there was a question that came in about the quantified self. So the quantified self refers to kind of a movement that started in the health sciences, I would say, where there's lots of devices that people can now kind of attach to their bodies to get a sense for, you know, different things like your heart rate, how much you walked in a day, things like that. But now that movement is kind of working its way more into higher education, where students are wanting to quantify, measure, observe, monitor things around their teaching and learning behaviors. So we're seeing a little bit of that moving into higher ed. And one example of that could be learning analytics with dashboards that are student-facing and things that allow students to monitor their own experience. So I think that's one way in the way we're seeing that transfer from what was a kind of a consumer technology to more of a teaching and learning technology. And here we're seeing some of the results of the poll, which asked about the technologies that you're working with at your institution, and it looks like Flipped is number one and Learning Analytics is a close second. So you're pretty much in line with the Horizon report, so that's kind of assuring. That's great. Okay, and we can go ahead and move on to the next slide. The next slide is one other video that is on makerspaces, which is kind of a quickly maturing, rising area. So I'll let that video play. Let's see if that works okay. And this was a submission from University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign on 3D printing, but it's also got some makerspace stuff in there.
Everything you see here in this lab is made by an individual, not by a large company. So we set up this lab about a year back with the objective of getting business students involved with students from across campus who learn by making. So our motto is learn, make, and share. And we encourage to learn prototyping, learn designing, and learn by making the models on 3D printers.
Great. Thanks, Lauren. And you can view all of these videos and all the submissions that were made to the competition at the URL that I posted there in chat. All right, so we've got one last poll here in this section, and it asks, what are the most significant obstacles in implementing these technologies? We know that there's lots of challenges. Some of them are cost. Others are, getting people to understand how to use them effectively in the classroom. And so we just wanted to get a sense from you all what you think the most significant obstacle is in going with some of these technologies. And while you're weighing in, there was a question that came in about the flipped classroom. And I think there's lots of different interpretations of the flipped classroom. At its base, I think it means that some of the content that would have typically been covered in class is now distributed to an outside of class mode. That could be viewing a lecture online. It could be doing something outside of class time. The point of it is so that in-class time is spent in a more effective way, doing the things that you have to be in person to do effectively. So again, that could take lots of different shapes and forms, but it doesn't always have to be the strict interpretation of videos being done online. So looking at the poll here, it looks like lack of support and time to implement is number one, and cost is number two. Okay, great. Thank you. Very, very interesting results. And with that, I will turn it back over to Malcolm.
Thanks very much, Veronica. We're now at a transition. We're going to now bring on our guest speaker. So the first speaker is Professor Jim Harvey, George Mason University. And his presentation is an illustration of the fast trend of the integration of online, hybrid, and collaborative learning. So, Jim, I invite you to take it away.
Thanks, Malcolm, and hello to everyone. This is Jim Harvey, Associate Dean of Students and Associate Professor of Marketing in the School of Management at George Mason University. George Mason is public institution in the state of Virginia that probably nobody ever heard of. In fact, we've got the largest enrollment in the state with 33,000 students and 6,000 students in the School of Management. And basically what I want to talk about for the next 15 minutes is a course that several of us developed. It's a required marketing course that is taken by every major in the School of Management that addresses several of the trends that have been talked about today, including flipped classrooms, collaborative learning, and learning analytics. Rather than trying to go out and develop all this myself or ourselves, we adopted the McGraw-Hill platform of Connect and Learn Smart, and we'll talk more about that later. The basic premise of this course is that because George Mason has a lack of classroom space in the evening, a couple of us felt that if we could take the same classroom and teach two classes at the same time by alternating, that we'd save some space for the university. So in this presentation, what I'm going to do is to summarize what we've attempted to achieve and the measures and the outcomes we used, and some of the publications about distance learning and the pieces that that stem from this work. As I mentioned, George Mason's in Northern Virginia, halfway in between Dulles Airport and Capitol Hill. We have a lot of international students, which makes teaching particularly interesting, but we also have a lot of first-generation college students and a whole lot of traffic. If Northern Virginia were a country, we'd be the 24th largest country in terms of GDP. What used to take 20 minutes 5 years ago now takes an hour to get across town. So time is very important to our students, to our faculty, and particularly the students that we serve. For most of them, working 20 hours or more, and sometimes working full-time outside of class. So what I hope to do over the next 10 to 15 minutes is to provide a broad overview of this effort, of how we developed a hybrid distance learning initiative, and to summarize the way we assessed the effectiveness of the project. wanted to also provide a few pieces of the academic literature that we relied on. The objective of the initiative included providing students with greater time flexibility, provide the university with improved space capacity, and in the notion of flipping and student analytics, we wanted to free class time from focusing on declarative discipline knowledge. We wanted to reserve class time for more synthesis, problem solving, and collaboration. The findings of our assessment show that there is a significant positive relationship between the online student performance and test results. And I also want to talk about some literature review that we reviewed that we also found to be true, and that was that there was a strong positive effect of collaboration. So every other class met online, and every other class met face-to-face. The hybrid portion of the course used McGraw-Hill Connect and Learn Smart exercises, and that was our operational definition of flipping the class. Now, a lot of the online exercises not only looked at the notion of declarative knowledge, but there was also some problem solving and integration through the use of online videos, followed up by multiple choice questions. Another portion of the online exercise included a product McGraw-Hill has called LearnSmart, which is actually an adaptive learning algorithm. What LearnSmart does is to make the questions more difficult if you get it right, and to finish your assignment sooner if you got it right. But if you got it wrong, to give you easier questions and to provide you with individual feedback at the end of the assignment. The course also required teams to work together to create a rudimentary semester project that we call a marketing plan. The collaboration opportunities and platforms that we used and relied on included Skype, Google Plus Hangout, and Blackboard Collaborate. Slide 4 gives you a student view of the assignments for the week. And so students would enter each one of these dates, and each assignment was time stamped. So we know exactly when they entered the assignment, how long it took to complete the assignment, what their score was, and then, as I mentioned earlier, students were given feedback on the success. Slide 5 gives you an example of the type of drag and drop approach to declarative knowledge that students were assigned. And in this case, the question is, well, what's the difference between marketing products and marketing services? The Connect Online exercises provided items that required students to learn the discipline through these drag and drop opportunities. Slide 6 shows that some of the online exercises were a little bit more challenging, a little bit more sophisticated, to include video analysis with followed up by multiple choice questions, break-even analysis, and so forth. As I mentioned earlier, the nice thing about this platform from a learning analytics perspective is that each student was given a list of items within the chapter where they were strong and where they struggled. And then the professor was given an aggregate result of student performance, so that when we did meet face-to-face, I had a pretty good roadmap of where time needed to be spent to address problem areas. Let me turn to the literature just briefly that we relied on, and I suspect based on what I see by the demographics of the audience, that this is probably old news to you. It was pretty interesting to me, though. I found a study that was done by Chow Li, Yin, Lai, and Tan from a variety of universities, but I think the lead author is from Michigan State, that discussed one of the key questions, and that is there a difference or not between distance learning and face-to-face? This is the so-called no-difference hypothesis. And in this study, what the researchers did was to conduct what's called a meta-analysis of over 500 studies of distance learning to try to test that hypothesis. And in fact, what they found was that in terms of student performance, there is no difference between distance learning platforms and face-to-face platforms. But a particular interest is that if you look at, as the authors did, some of the substratas of the data, they found that when the study was conducted by the instructor who was doing the distance learning effort showed greater student, more positive student results. The second thing that kind of led our study was embedded in this study as well, and that is that distance learning programs with a combination of technology as well as face-to-face, what we call hybrid or blended, actually had the most positive outcomes. And so this literature was a brief guide, provided a brief guide for some of the work that we did. We also looked at some of the best practices literature, and I just commend that to you. And I want to emphasize a little bit more at the bottom of slide 8 and go on to slide 9. In 2006, Hall wrote about the notion of learning nets, and you're probably familiar with it. I was not familiar with it, but this really kind of emphasizes the notion of collaborative learning, that when you get students interacting with one another and create these learning nets that foster peer collaboration, student performance improves significantly. And so here we have the first assessment that we published on this work, and that is the relationship between online performance and in-class exams. And as you can see, it's a fairly nice curvilinear relationship with a reasonably significant amount of explained variation. But basically, as advertised, a positive relationship between work online and work in class. Another piece of literature that I encourage you to read of if you have the time is done by Perser in 2011. And this is a study that was conducted by using engineering students. And that Perser did a very elaborate controlled experiment of engineering students that looked at the issue of collaboration. And what Perser found is that there should be, and there was, a significant positive relationship between class performance and the support that the leaders received from others. So we felt like we were really kind of on solid ground in terms of predicting that collaboration should have a significant effect on student performance, and so we decided to test that as well. And in fact, consistent with Perser's work, we found that of 400 students, about 48% of them self-reported that they did a lot of work with other people, and a significant portion, about 38% of the students said they're kind of loners, they didn't really collaborate with others. And basically what we did was run median splits on those self-reports, and we found that students who did, in fact, collaborate found that the class was more interesting, that they were more engaged in the course, that the course was more worth the money, that the online assignments helped more with the semester project, that the textbook was more interesting, and that they felt better, that they understood the course better. So to summarize, the current approach that we used in this course showed that there are some demonstrated benefits of a blended approach, and that, in fact, if you could get students to collaborate, they had a higher level of course enjoyment and course performance. Well, folks, that's essentially the end of my presentation. I look forward to having some questions and comments that you have about it that I could clarify. Mason's a great place to teach. It's a great place to learn. We're close to the capital of the United States. We have students from about 125 different countries. It's a very, very interesting place to live and to work.
So Jim, it's Mark. There are a couple interesting discussions that were going on the chat board while you were talking. And one of them, the question is, and I'm going to soften the question a little bit, about wondering about your faculty's reaction to delegating some of the content over to a textbook company. It seemed like many of the assignments and some of the things that they did online were developed by the textbook company and fit with the textbook as opposed to be instructor developed. Is that a right assumption? And were there problems with it with the faculty? Or
that assumption is absolutely correct, and that's a great question because that's been a significant topic. Basically, the dilemma for the professor is, do we go out and hire a bunch of course development people? Do we do it ourselves? Do we rely on professionals from the publisher? And I can tell you there are a lot of my colleagues who do not like this idea at all. Now, what approach I take on this is that point number one is that it seems to work fairly well. I think also we need to be mindful of the fact that students tend to self-select themselves into distance learning platforms. And so students who are a little bit more highly motivated, people who like the time flexibility, know that this is a distance or hybrid or blended section, and they opt in, and those who don't care about it opt out. It really is, however, I think, a reminder that something I really believe in is that when you take a course, you don't take a course from a textbook. You take a course from a professor. And so on the face-to-face components of the class, what I try to do is to work through whatever issues the students have about the declarative knowledge of the discipline, but try to craft the class in terms of the perspective that I see about the discipline of practice of marketing. So you're absolutely right. This is not particularly well-liked, but I can tell you by some folks, some of my faculty colleagues, but the cost of producing at the level of professionalism that this particular vendor provided is way beyond our budgets.
And that's kind of your comment about the professor is interesting. There was one of the discussions going on, someone who took a course using this type of technology, and it was more of a self-paced and missed the interaction. And I think that's one of the intriguing parts about the flipped classroom is instead of maybe go home and read the textbook, it's go home and watch the video. But the conversation, the discussion, the learning, the self-created knowledge can happen in the classroom. So that's good. I've got a second question was that the fee structure, was it a normal – excuse me, was there an added fee for this, or was the textbook a purchase that included that, or how was that work?
That's another very, very good question, a very complicated question, because, in fact, this particular vendor has a relatively complex pricing structure. What most of our students do is that they purchase what's called the e-book, and so within the e-book, this so-called add-on is included. If they, on the other hand, choose to buy a brand new hardcover book, the Connect exercises and the online exercises are an additional $40. It's a significant increase in the cost to the student. And so what I find is that a lot of students just don't buy the textbook, and they buy the online exercises. And they will share a textbook, or they'll rent a textbook, or they'll get a textbook from India, or other ways to save some money.
That's great. One of my big issues with e-textbooks is do the students get to have access to the e-textbook at a future time, or once the course is over, are they frozen out?
Once again, that really varies publisher to publisher, and my understanding is that McGraw-Hill gives you access for 6 months. The other benefit of the e-book is it is searchable text, and so students find that once they get used to the e-format, they're able to move through the textbook a lot faster to find the topics that they're interested in.
So I'm going to give you the one last question, and then I think it's probably time to move on because we got another speaker. Have you done anything different to your classrooms because now that there's collaboration going on, have you changed your format of your classrooms, different style of classrooms, made any changes?
Well, it really depends on whether I'm teaching the blended format or not, but within the context of the blended format, I do everything I can to encourage collaboration. So from day one, I have the students. Can you hear me okay, Mark?
Yeah, you dropped for a second, but we're good.
Yeah, I pushed the wrong button. From day one, I get the students in the front of the classroom using the technology and assigning them to teams. And so there's a distinct team format in my approach to teaching. They have a semester project that they have to work on together. They're provided a template to look at a brand, look at an industry, look at trends within that industry, and at the end of the semester to post their presentation on YouTube. So collaboration is very important, but I try my best to encourage it.
That's great. And I think, Malcolm, you're going to lead off with the next speaker.
Yes, very, very quickly, so as we get the field slides up. So thank you very much, Jim. That was a very, very interesting, I think, an important study, an important work you're doing in terms of not only trying out these innovations, but actually trying to measure their impact, which is always useful. So we'll bring up Phil's slides now. And Phil, just to kind of just repeat Mark's earlier introduction, Phil is the Executive Vice Provost and Dean for ASU Online and Extended Campus at Arizona State University. So without any further ado, Phil, please begin.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. To begin, I do want to thank both Malcolm and Veronica and EDUCAUSE. I think these are great sessions, and I certainly look forward to this one. I have six words in the title here, Personalized Learning Using Continuously Adaptive Technology, and I have to tell you that 3 years ago, I didn't know what at least four of those words really meant in this context. What I'm going to talk about, when personalized learning is a continuum, and personalized learning simply means, in my estimation, using technologies in ways that allow a different educational experience for students depending upon what they know. Now, that can be something as simple as gating a course so that a student can't continue until they demonstrate mastery of material, which requires no adaptivity, or it can include something at the extreme end, which involves big data, large data sets, understanding how students move through courses by understanding correlations across different students and different patterns. And what I'm going to talk about today is one of those extreme versions where we are talking about using a big database in order to move through a course and in order for students to understand how to move through a course. The course we're talking about, and I'm actually discussing three courses here, were the freshman math courses at Arizona State, which we completely revised beginning in August 2011. And so we're now into the middle of the third year of providing freshman math courses with a new technology. The advances that we made were actually not just done at ASU. It was a partnership between an adaptive learning company, startup at the time named Newton, that's K-N-E-W-T-O-N, which is a limited liability corporation in Manhattan, And as soon as we had a relationship with Newton, it became apparent that we also needed a content provider. And so Pearson, the textbook company, or the what they refer to themselves as a learning company, was also heavily involved in this. What I want to do today is understand a little bit about what personalized learning is. I'll discuss some elements of what we refer to as the continuously adaptive model, but I think that you can generally think of it as big data. And then I want to discuss the role of the faculty member in these courses, because one thing we focused on initially was the technology, and we gave short shrift to the role of the faculty member. And it's clear to me in working through this after several semesters that technologies are exactly what they are. They are tools, and they reside within a learning ecosystem. And if you don't focus on the role of the faculty member and the role of the student, the technology by itself is not going to advance you in any significant way. And so the next slide I have, and Lauren, if you'd bring up this slide now, I think I can talk over this, but this is an animation. And Lauren's bringing it up. And Lauren, if I talk over this, can people hear me? Okay.
Yes, you should be able to.
Good, thank you. So here's what's going on. This is actually the track of students through a developmental math course at ASU in August 2012. And what you can see at the bottom is the passage of time from the beginning of the semester, semester in September to the end of the semester in December. Each one of those things that looks like little white fleas is a student, and each one of the circles is a bundle of concepts, and within the circles are small learning objects. The different colors just represent different categories of topics, like statistics, ratio and proportions, functions, etc. And so if you could play it once more, Lauren, the point I want to make here is that there are as many pathways through a course as there are students in the course. In this particular course, it is both self-paced, meaning students can begin and complete as quickly as they can get through the material. And it's also self-directed, which means that as soon as they begin, they unlock bundles of material and they don't have to go through the course sequentially. And when you open up a course and allow students to move through the course in that way, what you find, as I said, is there is not a pathway through the course. There are as many paths as there are students in the course. Thanks, Lauren. And now going back to the slides, our objectives here were to improve critical reasoning and subject matter mastery. We really wanted to improve what faculty members knew as they were going through the course, and we wanted to improve retention and student satisfaction. There was an obvious rush to change. And by the way, we began with these math courses because that's where everybody tends to begin. I mean, if you can't use technologies to improve math, you probably can't use technologies to improve stuff going forward in general. So we started with math, but we actually next August are also going to roll this out in a biology, physics, chemistry class, econ courses, and eventually probably a year from or next January, probably in psychology as well. But we began with math for obvious reasons. And by the way, the reason we're beginning with all of those courses is that they are large kind of freshman killer courses. They have high failure rates, meaning high numbers of students either withdraw or they get D's, or at Arizona State they get E's, which is an F at most places. In the case of the math courses, you can see we went from 28. Just look at the college algebra. We went from 48% of the students basically failing or getting a D or withdrawing from college algebra first time they attempted it to 38% in 1 year. So a 10% improvement, actually about a 20% improvement in a reduction in the failure rate, which was impressive, and which is really the reason why we decided, based on these results after just a year of doing this, we were going to move forward with it going forward. In terms of why start with math courses again, I think if you looked at your data at your institutions, you'd find exactly the same thing. And it doesn't have to be college algebra. It's whatever the first course that a student places into. So if it's college algebra, fine. If it's calculus, fine. If it's developmental math, fine. But the fact is, if a student either can't get through that course, so they get below a C or they withdraw, then your chances of retaining those students are dismal compared to students who get a C or better. And by the way, that's true even if you look at the calculus class. So you have students who place into calculus, but for whatever reason they don't get through the calculus course, your ability to retain those students is going to be very poor going forward. That's why we started with math. I want to talk a bit here about modes of personalization. And a lot of what we do and what we came to understand about adaptive learning is based on what we call the ICAP model of learning. And basically ICAP refers to, that's an acronym for interactive, constructive, active, and passive learning. And as you go from passive to active to constructive to interactive, all of the educational and learning science literature indicates that you will get better student outcomes. So worse is passive, better is active, next is constructive. And so a lot of what we were trying to do was make students active and constructive participants in their own education. So it's very similar to what Jim was talking about earlier in regard to learning nets. If you can get students to be constructive, to generate new knowledge, or to interact with each other, the learning outcomes time and time again are going to be better. We started, of course, with large lecture halls. Now, in math, we weren't teaching in large lecture halls, but we were lecturing to 65 students at a time, and the impact was exactly the same. It's passive learning. Now, here's the great irony. Faculty members tend to believe that face-to-face is a more personalized mode of connecting than using technologies like flipped classrooms. But in fact, the technologies allow a much greater degree of personalization than a faculty member ever has in a lecture room. When I'm lecturing to a group of students, I am treating every one of those students exactly the same way. We give a midterm, students find out two or three times during the semester how well they're doing, and guess what? The next Monday, we move on. The type of resources that we're using and the type of resources that adaptive learning technologies allow you to use actually allow the learning experience to be personalized for the different students.
So, Phil, I got a quick question for you. A couple of questions come in, and I think we're
okay
with time. So there were some questions in there about Bloom's taxonomy and higher levels of learning, and you addressed it just beautifully in this last slide about constructive and interactive.
Right.
So I think that one's answered, but how does that address self-learning, where's the role for a faculty member, and how does that shift or adjust
So if you don't mind, I'm going to put that off because I have a couple of slides at the end. The role of the faculty member really, I believe, is elevated in these. Now, you know, a couple of things are necessary, but if you don't mind, I'm going to talk about the role of the faculty member in a couple of slides. And,
not a problem.
And so did you have another question you wanted to ask, Mark?
Actually, I did. The other couple of questions that came on were collaborative learning, the fact that now if this is self-paced, it's hard to get groups together and have people do things in groups. And again, if you've got another slide on that, we can shift. But otherwise, how does this fit?
No, actually, that's a great question. When we started this, we didn't understand the, you know, what we wanted faculty to do was kind of poorly defined. And the way our courses work is that all students are required to go to a computer lab once a week, and then students meet in a classroom once a week. And in the computer lab, and you can see on the slide I have now, these are all computer labs shots. It's really amazing because I've been in computer labs before, and they tend to be relatively noisy places. When you go to these computer labs, and I think it's because of the continuously adaptive and personalized features of this, it's dead quiet in there. And students will raise their hand. In this case, an instructor walks by and talks with students. And the attendance is very strong right until the time that the student is out of the course. Now, what we are experimenting with and what we're going to do and what we do increasingly in the course going forward is grouping students. And that was something that we didn't understand quite at the beginning. But instructors have a dashboard, and this is incredibly important. This is one of the big insights that, you know, it was kind of a side benefit. An instructor dashboard allows, and students are grouped according to where they are in the course. And so in that instructor session where students come, and by the way, they're in groups of 100 now, an instructor can quickly see the 8 students at the bottom of the course who need the most attention. They're the ones who are farthest back. And so they can group those students, move them into a different section of the classroom, and work with those students separately. The students who are advancing rapidly can work together and work on some higher level problems. And the students in the middle may need a mini lecture. Again, they'll be grouped according to their competency level in the course. And so, but you're right. What happens sometimes is that students are so far ahead that they're out of the course. And so we kind of started a process whereby if a student was at least 2 lessons ahead in the adaptive portion of the course or the computer section of the course, some of the instructors don't have the students come to class. But for the most part, we have all the students come to classes all the time, and we simply group them by competency and then provide them different interactivities based upon where they are in the course. This is going to become much more important when we go into the bio, chem, physics, and econ courses next year, where we're really going to concentrate much more on the personalized and group problem solving sessions as an important component, as an important, I won't say ancillary, but as an important component of the student learning that goes on in the course in order to advance the critical thinking skills of the student. Very quickly, a couple of things that are important here is the technology does not allow students to get through any possible important concept without mastering it. That doesn't mean that all students get A's, although that would be the natural outcome of a continuously adaptive learning model. But it does mean that if you're in a college algebra course, you can't go into a pre-calculus course with a 70% in college algebra, but not knowing the most essential features that you need in order to pass the pre-calculus class. And so we got away from students getting through a course with big holes in their knowledge and moving forward. In terms of pedagogy, again, it is flexible pacing, so students can accelerate their progress. And I'm going to show you a graph later on that shows how students actually got through the course. And we are always monitoring the student. So at all times, the student and the instructor know exactly what the student has mastered. The instructor can see the individual student dashboards. In addition to having an instructor dashboard that shows what students are on track and off track, the instructor also can drill down and see the individual student dashboard and see where they're stuck. In terms of the technologies, we kind of group it in 3 places. There are adaptive systems, which deal with how the content's delivered to the students. There are tracking systems, which allow the instructor to see and the student to understand their progress. And then there are grouping systems, which allow the instructor to understand how best to address the different students in groups in their course. This is just a graph showing the level of complexity. This is a knowledge graph for the developmental math course. You have to have every concept and show its relationship to every other atomic concept in the course in order to make a truly adaptive learning class. And this is a complex thing, but once it's done, and it functions for a long time. Just in terms of best practices, and I want to do, I have just a few more slides. One thing that we didn't understand again at the beginning is the importance of fostering a support structure for faculty as well as students. And so we now have group trainings where instructors share the best practices. And by the way, the instructors have taken this over at this point. There was resistance at the beginning. There is virtually no resistance now. They see that it actually improves the student experience, and that's where we wanted to get to. And we do have a mentoring system for new instructors because you don't want to drop new instructors into the a program like this and hope that they can figure it out. We have, this has allowed us to make a set of data-driven decision-makings, data-driven decisions. And so if you don't mind, I'm going to explain this very briefly. But what these four charts are four different sections of the course. The green is students who are on track. And so as you move from the left of a chart to the right of a chart, what you're seeing is progress through a semester. Yellow and red demonstrate students who are a little off track and a lot off track. So in terms of being able to evaluate which instructors are doing really well in this environment, you know, the instructor on the left needs additional training. The instructors on the right do much better at keeping their students on track during the course. This, by the way, shows when students actually completed, this is a college algebra course for last year, and you can see that a significant number of students, about 60% of the students actually complete the course before the end of the semester, and that's something that allows the greater efficiencies. We have had to change how we plan the lab space, and it also obviously caused us to rethink the completion policies for the course. In terms of the role of the faculty, if you start at the bottom of this slide and work up, we're starting from lower order stuff to very high order stuff. At the bottom, what instructors hate doing is kind of taking attendance and collecting homework and problem sets and grading it and lecturing. And as you move up, you know, they prefer to answer questions, lead interactive exploration of topics, and develop new learning methods and materials. What we have allowed faculty to do as a result of this is spend a lot less time on the bottom four bullets. They do almost no work on the bottom four bullets. What they are working on is especially the interactive exploration of concepts and answering questions. Now, this means that the role of the faculty member changes. They lecture almost not at all compared to what they used to do. They might lecture for 5 minutes a class. They lead problem-solving activities with students. They have, in general, you know, it allows them to teach, to identify the students who need the most help at the point they need the help, and work with the top students in the class in order to push them in a way that's not possible when they can't either identify the top students or they don't have time to work with the top students because they have to lecture and they're spending most of their time lecturing. So I actually think that is my last slide. And I'm sorry, I think I went a little bit over, but if anybody has any questions or Mark, if you'd like to ask something, please go ahead and do so.
Yeah, I would, and then we'll get back to the group. So I'm going to do one last question for you because there's been an interesting discussion on everything from how many students have devices to can they get access to your discussion on the role of the faculty member, and it's mm-hmm. kind of an interesting transition that using that data to help. Mm-hmm. My question is kind of, it's hard for me to understand if the students are doing so much of this online with the learning resource, how you've integrated and made that hybrid classroom. Near the end, you talk about it a little bit more. So is it really more of a hybrid situation that the students are learning the concepts and you have the higher order thinking and activities in the classroom? Is that
Yeah,
what
it is. It's hybrid, but it's not flipped in the traditional sense. You know, students do get the concepts, and they do, I'm sorry, students get the content online, and that you know, we make students go to a computer classroom, but the fact is they can access that from their dorm room 24/7. The reason we make them go to a classroom is because they're freshman students, and we found early on that they benefit from the discipline that's associated with going to a class. So we make them do that until they're through the class. But then when they go into the classroom, the role of the faculty member is really much more around, for example, the faculty member now knows that, for example, maybe 20 or 30% of the students have trouble with a particular concept. He or she can do one of two things. They can group the students, those 20 to 30% of the students, in a section of the classroom and just work with them on that. He can do a mini lecture with those 20 or 30. He can do a mini lecture with the entire class where he spends 5 or 8 minutes talking about a particular concept that is causing a lot of people into class trouble. But typically what instructors do now is they divide the class at the beginning into different groups and give students different activities to work through. And then the instructor will walk around the classroom and make sure that the students who need help get the most help from the instructor, and the students who need the least help are progressing and being given more challenging material.
Thanks, Bill. So what I'd like to do, we have about 6 minutes left, and I need a couple to close up. So I have a question essentially for everybody. And Malcolm, since you've kind of been orchestrating, I'm going to let you start out. There was a question, and I know it's hitting all of our campuses, on accessibility. And as we start using some of these technologies and everything from video and captioning to interactivity to Hangouts to all the things we've talked about, some of those issues become fairly challenging. So are there any responses, answers, ideas that you've been coming up with or that came out of the Horizon report that might help lead to directions for some of those things?
Can I comment on that from George Mason?
Please.
Just briefly, what little I know about that is that that is a very big issue at our university. We have an office. We have the Office of Disability Services, and they're very concerned, working on it. Go to the George Mason GMU.edu website and see what they're doing. I know that I've had visits to my office from that representatives from that office. It is a very big issue.
Okay, and then I just noticed Veronica has a closeout piece. So, Veronica, if you'd leave us off, and please leave me about a minute and a half before so we can close out.
Sure thing. I wanted to show as we close up here just in a little more detail an image that we saw earlier in the webinar, and it's the expanded creative classroom research model. And this model, while I think is a good one to aspire to, and we've heard some good examples of this in action, it's extremely ambitious and arguably requires an entire institution to support it in order to achieve it. And one thing that's pretty evident in this model is the level of skill and effort required of the faculty. In fact, looking at the Horizon report as a whole, here's kind of that cover sheet of the table of contents, we see some acknowledgement of the importance of support and engagement from the instructional side of the house. And from ELI's perspective, we know how important faculty development efforts can be. And for that reason, we are turning some significant attention to the topic of faculty development in 2014. And here you see a three-part faculty development program that we are launching actually on Monday with a seminar on determining the effectiveness of faculty development programs, to be followed by a focus session, which is all, these are all online events, by the way. And then culminating in June with a short course on faculty development. And you can read more about that on our events site. I also want to mention that this is a three-part program, and those who are actively engaged in it are going to be recognized with a faculty development mastery badge, and we hope that this will help to signal individual achievement in the area for those that participated, but also show the significance of the subject matter to the teaching and learning community. And just really quick to close, the focus session has been guided by a team of expert faculty developers, if you will. And I wanted to show you just really quickly some of the key topics that the advisory group in this area from the community kind of raised up as the top issues and kind of new things, too, very different from sort of the old faculty development stuff that you might be familiar with. And so these are some of the areas that we'll be focusing on during the online event in April, April 1, 2, and 3. And then just really quick in closing, I wanted to put this poll out to folks, and maybe we can do this while Mark is making some comments. But I wanted to weigh in with the community. Ooh, this is a little tricky, a little wordy on the polls. It's my bad. Looking at these areas, which of these are most significant to you in your work? And as you're chiming in on that, I'll be keeping an eye on it. And maybe, Mark, you can get to your closing remarks.
That's perfect. On behalf of all the attendees and all of us listening, I want to thank the presenters and the conversation. It was an excellent coverage of a pretty complicated subject. So thank you all, and thanks to the participants for joining us from all around the web. Before you sign off, there are two links in the left-hand chat window. One would be where you can find the archive. As you know, all of our sessions are archived with the slides, the speakers, and the chat sessions. Also, there's a survey. We'd appreciate that so we can continue to provide with content that you want to hear about, and those surveys are important. As you know, that's that part of that feedback loop that for adaptive learning, well, here we are doing that. As you mark your calendars, March 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Christopher Brooks, Senior Research Fellow with EDUCAUSE, and J.D. Walker, Research Associate at the University of Minnesota, will be presenting a seminar on sifting through data, completion, motivation, and learning in the Minnesota MOOCs. This has been a production of EDUCAUSE Live, production from EDUCAUSE, the Higher Education Technology Association. On behalf of PATH of EDUCAUSE, I'm Mark Hoyt, and I want to thank you for joining us for another EDUCAUSE Live, and we'll listen to you next time. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye. Okay, everyone. Right. Thank you all, Veronica, Malcolm, Jim, and Phil. There may be people listening on the line. Some people do dial in, but the recorded session and all is done. I want to thank you all for participating. That went really smoothly. I'm glad we had the extra half hour that was needed. And any comments, any questions other than that, I'll just thank you all and look forward to seeing you when we're at, where are we going for EDUCAUSE, wherever the next one is.
Orlando.
This is Phil Regeer. Thank you very much. I think you guys do a great job of organizing these events and minimizing technical issues.
Yeah, kudos to Lauren for a great job with the videos in particular.
Yep.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, and thanks to Vic, too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, bye.
All.